Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. Hey, if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Time travel, is it real? Is it illusion? We'll speak with best-selling author James Gleick, who delivers a mind-bending exploration of time travel. From H.G. Wells to Doctor Who, from Proust to Woody Allen, it's a history of time travel and the science and or science fiction behind it.
Well, I'm looking forward to that conversation. Good morning, Lynn. And then what it's like to be a dog and other adventures in animal neuroscience. We think we know our dogs. We assign emotions, even thoughts to them. But how do you get to the science? Well, as we learn, you train the dogs to lie quietly in an MRI scanner, of course. And then what does the science tell us? Well, stay tuned to hear the science behind our dogs' experiences.
Those two guests, when we return, it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, time travel. It's part science fiction, it's part physics, part storytelling. It's a concept that has preoccupied physicists and storytellers over the course of the last century. Our first guest, James Gleick, delivers a mind-bending exploration on the topic, from its origins in literature and science to its influence on our understanding of time itself. Gleick explores physics, technology, philosophy, and art as each relates to time travel and tells the story of the concept's cultural evolutions. We're pleased he could join us on Cool Science Radio. James Gleick, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. Well, you know what? After you have written this exploration of the history and the science behind time travel, why do you think we are so fascinated with it, whether it's in science fiction or real hard science?
Well, there are so many reasons that we want to travel through time. I mean, at the moment, I can't help but notice every morning that it's still 2017. And I wish it were some other year, in the past or the future. Sometimes we want to travel through time to go back, to get a do-over. I think regret is a big motivator. And other times we're curious about the future. That's how it started with H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells in 1895 wanted to tell a story about an imaginary future of the Earth and the human race. And in 1895, he didn't have a way to get his readers there except by inventing this cockamamie machine that he called the time machine.
And so H.G. Wells, it's interesting in your story, you kind of illustrate how he went between the science fiction that he himself had created, and then he became so immersed in it that it's almost as though he believed it himself, as well as woke up an entire world to possibly believing it as well.
Except that he didn't believe it in the end. He just felt he was creating a kind of trick to enable his storytelling, and he disappointed his fans for the rest of his life, who would write to him and say, well, I have an idea of how you could make this time travel thing work. And he would say, well, no, I was kidding, and he went on to other things. But he had opened the floodgates, because it is a powerful idea. It's a fantastic kind of wish fulfillment. You know, what if I could go back and meet William Shakespeare and watch him working with his players in Elizabethan England, or meet Isaac Newton would be one of my choices, since I wrote a book about him, and I'd like to know if any of it was true.
Ah, that's funny. So the three dimensions are up and down, forwards and backwards, to the left and to the right. And then I think it was roughly 1918 that Einstein came out and said that space-time was the fourth dimension. And I just thought that was amazing. And you know, Einstein's so smart, and he came up with this thing. But it was really H.G. Wells back in the late 1800s and some of his contemporaries that started talking about time as an element, as being a fourth dimension. And so I'm curious, how was Einstein affected by popular culture?
I was curious about that, too, to the extent of sort of hoping that I would find a letter or a note in a diary that would show Einstein reading the time machine, but I don't think he ever did, and he didn't really need to. It wasn't that Einstein got his ideas from science fiction. That wouldn't be necessary. He was thinking in a different realm. But what is true is that H.G. Wells in the 1890s and Albert Einstein, who in those years was still a student in Munich,
a young pup.
They were living in the same world. They were experiencing the same technologies, and some of those technologies included railroad trains, and every railroad station had an electric clock. And these clocks, we know, fascinated Einstein. And the clocks themselves had to be synchronized by means of telegraph signals sent from station to station. And all of these technologies, which are, you know, so much a part of our furniture that we don't even notice them, were brand new. And in the world of their parents and grandparents, there were not only no railroad trains and no electric telegraphs, but there was no sense of simultaneity from one place on the globe to another. No sense that there was no need for time zones. There was barely anyone who understood what the international dateline was. You know, we've got all this apparatus about time that has emerged in a world that was created. This is the argument I believe in strongly, by both of these realms of our culture, by the theoretical physicists like Einstein and by the imaginative storytellers, beginning with people like H.G. Wells.
Yes. And so H.G. invented time travel by machine, and then someone like Proust talked extensively about time travel by the mind. So if perception is reality, then we can travel in time by extrapolating what we think may happen in the future or what we would like to perceive.
Well, for better or for worse, that's the best kind of time travel we've got. You know, it might be disappointing for listeners who are hoping to get that machine or build it in their garage, but I think mental time travel is more and more powerful. And mental time travel, by the way, is a term that psychologists actually use to talk about our ability as conscious creatures to project ourselves into the past and into the future. You mentioned Proust. He was just a little bit younger than H.G. Wells and wouldn't use the words time travel himself, but he was all about time. His great masterwork was In Search of Lost Time. And as you say, he imagined dreaming of the past in his almost magic armchair. And, you know, it was as if he had flying carpets back to the past. And then in the past, he would remember dreaming of the future. Time was something that was getting more and more fluid as the centuries changed.
If you're just joining us, our guest is James Glick. He is the best-selling author of the book The Information. He's written a new book called Time Travel, A History. And James, we're getting a lot of static. I don't know if you can improve your background noise at all, but we can hear you. There's just a lot of background there. But let's go into this intersection of mental time travel and physics. I've heard it said that thought is matter. Can you comment on that?
Thought is matter. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. I think they're actually quite different. I mean, our brains are made of matter. I'll go along with that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then, I mean, have you found in your exploration an intersection or a place where the concept of mental time travel can have an explanation via physics?
Well, physicists have become the experts we turn to when we want to know what time is, I suppose. When H.G. Wells first started thinking about his version of a time machine, he had to make a case that time is just another version of space. If you can travel through it, then it must be a sort of space for you to be a traveler, and you're going from one place to another. And we have a lot of words in ordinary language that treat time and space the same way. But really, we also know at exactly the same time that time is very different from space, that you in space you can go to the left, you can go to the right, you can go up, you can go down, but the past is actually gone. It was real, but it's not real anymore. The future, we can imagine it, and maybe it's going to arrive, but it hasn't happened yet. What I'm expressing is an unscientific man in the street, common sense view of time, which didn't work for people who wanted to imagine time travel, and also is contradicted or superseded by Einstein's version of reality, in which, at least mathematically speaking, the past and the future are the same. They're just different directions in our great four-dimensional space-time continuum.
And how is that concept accepted throughout the community that is hoping for time travel, that that the past and the future are all the same, along with the present?
Well, you sort of have to believe that, right? I mean, if you think that you're going to be able to walk through a portal or get into a machine, set the dial for the year 2062, and walk through and see what they're doing there, then you're sort of imagining that the year 2062 is there already waiting for you to arrive. It's happening in a place that ordinarily we don't have access to. And in the same way, if you imagine that you could take your time machine back to the past, you're kind of claiming that the past still exists. It has not vanished from reality. Well, which do you think is true? A physicist, many physicists treat the past and the future in exactly that way because that's the way it looks in their equations. They can model the entire universe as a space-time continuum, and the instant that we call now isn't special in their equations. It just feels special to us.
And you talked, James, about, you spoke earlier about the power of time travel by the mind. And I remember distinctly, I think I was like 9 or 10 years old, living in New York, the first time that I saw the movie adaptation of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And I think that was written in the mid-1800s, before H.G. Wells' Time Machine came out. And I was just blown away by the part where he is visited by the ghost of Christmas past. He gets to see himself the way he was before and how he interacted with people. The ghost of Christmas present, well, that was right there in his face. He was living that. But the most powerful thing was the ghost of Christmas future, which is sort of an extrapolation of all his behavior in the past and in the present and where he could be in 5 or 10 years, which was basically everybody hated him and he died. And that was just a powerful lesson for a kid. And I think about that from time to time because, you can look at your behavior today and in the past, and you can extrapolate into the future, and you can draw a pretty good picture of how things are going to be unless you make certain changes.
Yeah, that's what I love about time travel as a genre. That's what I love about this kind of storytelling. It enables you to consider parts of our emotional lives, parts of our intellectual lives that you'd have trouble exploring another way. I mean, so many of the when you take away the mechanics of time travel, you know, the machinery and the science of it, you're exploring different aspects of real life. Let's say you're a teenager, you know, you're developing, you're growing older, and one day you look at your parents across the breakfast table and you think, whoa, you know, I have all of these feelings, and they once upon a time were exactly my age, and they were, they were teenagers too, and did they feel the way I feel now? And the next thing you know, you're Michael J. Fox or Marty McFly getting into a DeLorean and going to find out what your parents were like when they were teenagers.
Well, Lynn, I think that, James, if you're ever in Park City, you got to stop by here and we'll go out and have a beer or something and continue to talk about this, because I find this absolutely fascinating. And I do the same thing. You know, the first time I looked at my father and says, geez, I think I'm becoming this man. And it's all very interesting. I wanted to ask you about Einstein again. You tell the story of a friend of his who passed away. And he wrote a letter to the remaining folks, family of that person, where he said that he's not really gone. It's that time is a stubbornly persistent illusion. And I know that we know some things about the universe, but there are a lot of mysteries, and there's some things we will probably never know, and some things that we will never be able to conceive, especially when you start thinking about quantum theory at a detailed level. I mean, it's just bizarre. This may be right in front of us, but we just can't understand that it is a stubbornly persistent illusion. What do you think of that?
It's true. Einstein took a kind of comfort on the death of a friend, and really just a few weeks before his own death, in the physicist's view of the universe as all existing, past and future, all together, and there's an echo of that. Some science fiction fans might be reminded already of Kurt Vonnegut in Slaughterhouse-Five, who has this imagined world, Tralfamador, and he says the most important thing I learned on Tralfamador was that when a person dies, he only appears to die. He is still very much alive in the past. It's just an illusion we have here on Earth that one moment follows another one like beads on a string, and that once a moment is gone, it's gone forever. Well, that is, if it's an illusion, it's a powerful illusion. And we know, we're able to imagine the span of our lifetimes. I'm sorry if this is starting to sound a little philosophical, but, you know, we know that centuries of time went by before we were born, and there are going to be centuries again after we die. And being human beings, I think we tend to be a lot more comfortable with the first part of that equation. You know, we don't feel too bad about the centuries we missed before we're born, but I'm not too happy about having to die and miss what comes after.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm wondering, James, and as you were going through the research for this book, did you find that your preponderance or your predisposition towards enjoying physics or philosophy sort of jumped out and grabbed you more?
I've always been interested in writing about science, and I've always taken physicists maybe a little more seriously than philosophers, as a matter of prejudice. But for this book, for studying the history of the idea of time travel, it was all of a piece. We live in a complicated culture, and the fun of the book for me was watching ideas travel from one place in our culture to another. Philosophers in the 1920s were reading H.G. Wells's Time Machine. Even though he had just meant it as a fantastic story, they were taking it seriously and trying to figure out what it meant for the philosophy of time. And then over in another corner, physicists were very seriously and rigorously shuffling everything that we had previously thought we had known about time. And the philosophers had to listen to the physicists, and the physicists either did or didn't care about the philosophers, and meanwhile, they're all reading the same science fiction stories. So nowadays, you've got plenty of theoretical physicists who love nothing more than to talk about wormholes and how time travel might someday be managed.
Oh, that's interesting. And I wouldn't want to offend any quantum physicists, but isn't that where the whole field of quantum physics sort of came? And, you know, is by sort of a statement of philosophy, and then they kind of went backwards from there?
Well, I like to think that science is grounded in reality, in experiment, and doesn't have the luxury of just playing with words. Or at least scientists like to think that, but it's difficult to draw a hard line, mm-hmm. let's say, between science and philosophy. Both of these disciplines, both of these types of thinkers, are helping us wrestle with profound questions about the nature of our world.
I think one of the best illustrations of scientific-based ideas is Einstein. Again, going back to him, when he was a young boy, he used to think about one of the greatest marvels of technology of the time, which was the train, and he used to think hours on end of what it would be like to be a photon of light traveling with that train, and to be a photon of light where he was, where the train had left the station. And this became the basis of the what I believe, and James, you can correct me on this, I might have this wrong, but the twins paradox, the gist of it being on Earth there are two twins. One is in a spacecraft that travels at light speed or near light speed, which is, of course, very difficult to do. And the twin comes back 30 years younger, comes back 30 years later, maybe 10 years older, and the twin is an old man.
That's true. I mean, that's the closest thing we have to actual scientific fact. Scientists have measured these relativistic effects using the spacecraft we have, like the ones that operate our GPS systems. You know, GPS is enabled by essentially atomic clocks in orbit around the Earth, and they are accurate to the nanosecond. And so the scenario you're describing, the science fictional scenario, is quite real, and at least we can say with some certainty that the astronaut who returned to Earth a year or two ago after a year on the space station was a few milliseconds younger relative to his twin brother than he would have been if he had stayed home.
Exactly. And
for all the good it did him.
Yeah. and just to clear up a fallacy I hear all the time about Einstein, he didn't sit around and come up with a bunch of crazy equations and then just go out and publish them. He was imagining first what he thought possibilities were, and then he went out and tried to prove them mathematically through equations. But his greatest strength was his extraordinary imagination.
Imagination combined with rigorous mathematical power.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you, well, we've talked a lot about Einstein, a little bit about Proust, and I wanted to ask you about another character in your book, well, not character, someone that you discuss, and that's Richard Feynman. And I'm wondering how he enters into your book, Nobel Prize winner for the early studies of fusion. Is that right?
Of quantum electrodynamics and many other things. I wrote a biography of Richard Feynman a few years ago called Genius. So he's somebody I admire very much. And he's somebody who thought deeply about time. And you're right, he makes a cameo appearance in my time travel book, too, along with, I had to laugh when you said that that Albert Einstein and Marcel Proust were both characters in my book because, well, it's true, and it makes me think I've written a fairly weird book here. But Feynman, as a young student, was working on a piece of theoretical physics with his thesis advisor, John Wheeler, that involved the idea of particles moving backward in time. And he had to take that seriously. I mean, that's where the equations seemed to be leading. And young Dick and young Johnny went to visit Albert Einstein, who was, who, you know, by then was a god to them. And they pitched their idea to him, and he said, well, you know, it's not too ridiculous to consider.
Yeah, interesting. And before we let you go, I have to ask you about Woody Allen, and I'm so disappointed because it was the Woody Allen movie, the name of which I'm forgetting right now. It was my first, that got its hooks into me, you know, with regard to science fiction. I can't believe it was Woody Allen, but it was.
Oh, well, now you're testing me, but there are two Woody Allen time travel movies that I know of. One of them is Sleeper.
It was Sleeper.
Sleeper. That's the one. Thank
the
one you.
That's his remake of the Rip Van Winkle story, where the time traveler sleeps his way into the future. But also, remember Midnight in Paris?
Oh, absolutely. That was a very recent one. I love that.
James, before we let you go, I have to I just have to mention this. I was on the World Wide Web last night, and I Googled, is time travel real, just for fun, you know, just to see what's out there with all the folks. And there was this Charlie Chaplin movie that was made in the 30s that shows this woman walking across the street with a cell phone having a conversation. And, you know, so there were all these examples of how people have traveled back from the future, from the self, you know, with iPhones and everything else, and it was actually pretty funny. Obviously, doctored photographs and doctored film, but I just thought I'd mention because there's a lot of interesting thoughts out there about this subject.
Okay, I thought you were going to tell me what the internet had decided about whether time travel is real.
Oh no, I can't
Sorry,
do that. But
so it's still an open question.
But I will tell you, I enjoyed your book.
Thank you very much.
The book is Time Travel, A History, and our guest is best-selling author James Glick. James, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
Wow. And I had forgotten about Midnight in Paris.
That's right.
I mean, how could I forget? It was only a couple years ago, but I loved that movie. In fact, now that I think about it, my two favorite Woody Allen movies, and sometimes I just can't even stand them.
Yeah.
But Sleeper.
Oh,
I think it was I was about 8 years old when that came out.
And
I just
these really weird cars. And
yeah.
It was amazing.
It would be funny to go back and watch that now and see you know, how real it all is. Okay, it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We're going to come back after these words from our underwriters to talk about, things like placing dogs in MRI scanners to see what they think. We all want to know what our dogs think. Stay with us.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill supporting KPCW. We are celebrating summer at 352 Main with outdoor deck dining and Main Street views, serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm JW here with Lynn Ware Peake, our next guest, New York Times bestselling author, Gregory Burns. He takes us into the brains and minds of dogs and other wild animals, from dolphins to sea lions. But it's the dogs who were trained to lie still in an MRI scanner so scientists could see their brain processes. And that's a story that caught our attention on Cool Science Radio. Gregory Burns has written a new book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Gregory, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah. So we have taken a good look at your book, and how do you get dogs to lie patiently in an MRI scanner? I mean, I remember in the very beginning, you tell the story of Cairo, which was the dog that was in the Osama bin Laden raid, and I think you felt that if it could handle all the helicopter noise and everything else, you could probably train a dog to do this type of thing?
That's right. So I might be the only person who had that thought after seeing all the pictures of Cairo. But what had happened was that through most of my career for the last 20 years, I'd been studying the human brain, specifically having people go in MRI machines and have them do various decision-making tasks so we could understand how the human brain processes things like reward and punishment and risk and all sorts of interesting things like that. But probably, I think in the back of my mind, I'd been thinking about my own dogs and what they thought of specifically us. And really the question is whether the dogs hang around us because of the food that we provide, or do they actually have some kind of social bond? And so that was the trigger. And I paired up with a local dog trainer to see how we could do this. And it really boiled down to breaking down the elements of an MRI and figuring out, you know, how do you get a dog acclimated to it and actually have fun doing it. So it turned out not to be as difficult as we thought initially.
So this morning I was having a cup of coffee and my dog Porkchop was sitting next to me. And I asked Porkchop a question and he kind of cocked his head to the side and he was trying to tell me something in dog talk. And I sort of simplified the whole thing and kind of think I can read his emotions at various times when he's happy or when he's frustrated or things like that. How close are we to reading our dog's emotions?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, so in science, we always run the risk of anthropomorphizing animals, you know, projecting our emotions on them. And so that was really the impetus for doing this in the first place, because I wanted to know, I'd like to say for sure, more than just kind of my projection. And so the idea and where we've come since we started this is by looking directly at activity in a dog's brain while they're in a scanner and presumably experiencing certain emotions, that I think we're getting to the point where we can build a map of the dog's brain, and we find a lot of similarities to how the human brain is wired. So when a dog is experiencing something that he or she likes, we see activity in parts of the brain that correspond to the same parts of the brain in humans when they experience something that they like. And so you know, it's close to being kind of a brain decoder, so we can try to build up what the experience for the dog is and read out emotions. Now, we've focused only on positive emotions because we want to keep the project fun and you know, be very ethical about, you know, what we ask dogs to do. And so I think we're getting a map of kind of the positive space of emotions. And what we're seeing is that, yeah, they experience things very much like we do, whether it's something as simple as food or probably more importantly, just social reward, the bond with their human, whether it's seeing them or just a simple word of praise, seems to evoke the same activities that we see in analogous human areas of human brain.
Gregory, I'm a frequent practitioner of anthropomorphizing, or that's always been a hard word to pronounce. Anyway, of my dog, and your book has made me now look at my dog, who's now 13, who, when I look at him, I've projected my own feelings, as you say, onto this dog. I think he's looking at me with love and admiration, and I don't think he's looking at me as though he's saying, can I just have something to eat, please? And so I'm wondering, you know, we know so much about the brain as we have viewed the human brain on an MRI scan, about those, you know, those hormones that are released, the oxytocins and the different hormones that are related to that feel good, the love feeling. And I'm just wondering what you saw in there. And, you know, was there ever someone who could reach inside the MRI machine and give a dog a scratch on a belly and to see how their brain reacts to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, with oxytocin, so there is growing research of oxytocin in dogs, and much of the research is pointing to similar findings that we see in humans, namely that when you give oxytocin to a dog, they seem to act in kind of more social ways in many ways. In particular, they seem to look at their humans more. And dogs with higher levels of oxytocin seem to spend more time gazing at their owners, whether that's kind of gazing with the longing of love or gazing out of some other reason we don't know. But that's kind of why we're doing the MRI. And in fact, yes, we have done experiments where, you know, the person just reaches in and does give the dog a pet. Or, you know, just as good, giving a praise like, good girl, or, you know, that's fun. You know, and just talking to the dog. And we see activity in the parts of the brain that correspond to the same areas in humans when they experience those things. So a lot of my view of the dog brain is viewed through this lens of the human brain, and I see more similarities than differences.
So with regard to our dogs understanding our language, we know that border collies, they can understand up to like 115 words, but we have a tendency to use the same lovey dog talk over and over. Like I have these three or four sentences that I don't dare say on air about what I say to my dogs when I come home.
At a higher pitch.
I try to go for the low voice, but and I think that if I say those same lines over and over and over as I show them love and pet them, that, you know, ultimately they understand that. And I think a lot of people do that. What do you think about that?
So I think the thing that's amazing to me about dogs understanding our language is that they understand anything at all, because we humans, you know, we talk incessantly. It's like a constant stream of mostly gibberish. You know, we talk constantly, sometimes without really much content, right? It's amazing. But it's amazing that a dog can kind of pick out the salient words from that stream and figure something out. Now, we've done some early experiments in the MRI to try to figure out how dogs are doing this, because it's also very apparent that dogs don't have language capacity like humans do. I mean, no animal does, because they don't speak to us, for one, but they understand some things. And so the real question is when we say a word, do they understand that the word is a symbolic placeholder for something else, whether it's an object or an action or a person or a place? Because humans have that ability very easily. In fact, we seem born that way to acquire language. And what we're finding is that although dogs can do that in a limited way, they seem to be acquiring those associations by a very different mechanism, mainly through just brute force repetition. And it's more probably of linking those sounds to specific, probably mostly actions. They seem more wired to associate a word with an action rather than a particular object. So language is kind of where we differ probably the most, but we're still scratching the surface in that realm.
Yeah. We have had a guest on our program twice now. His name is Khan Kobajikov. I don't know if you know him.
Of course I do.
Oh, okay, great. So he started his work with prairie dogs and found through looking at voice patterns that in a lot of detail that a prairie dog could pop its head out of a hole and could see, you know, someone coming towards him. And he could ascertain the difference between a human and a coyote, a fat human and a skinny human, a fat human and a skinny human with a red or a blue shirt, and, you know, was able to really describe in some granularity and some detail what was approaching him. And he's trying to do the same thing now with dogs. We're going to be talking to him again in the next couple of weeks to get an update on if his black box is coming together or not. Do you know how that is going?
No, I didn't. I was not aware that he was doing the same thing with his dogs. I know of his work with prairie dogs, so I'll be interested to hear what he has to say. So I think the key thing that the difference between, say, prairie dogs and domestic dogs is their what we call their ecology, like where they actually live and what's important to them. So prairie dogs have an evolutionary pressure to care about predators. And so obviously they need to communicate that type of information to each other. Now, dogs, domestic dog, has kind of a different set of pressures. They might not really have much of any evolutionary pressure anymore now that we've taken them into our house. So they're going to care about different things. What they are, I don't know yet.
Yeah, as it turns out, the last update that I got was that he had presented at the Future in Review Conference, which is a futures conference that we have out here every year. And there was someone in the audience that was, I think, the number two engineer within Microsoft, and he has joined up with Khan now, and they're trying to build a black box that will be looking at a combination of voice patterns and body language. They think that body language is also important in trying to ascertain what a dog is trying to say. Have you had any experience looking at that?
We haven't done any work with body language, mainly because, you know, our approach using MRI, the dog has to be perfectly still, so they can't actually exhibit any body language. It might be possible to do something like that, you know, where that the dog in the scanner can actually see another dog's body language. And we did one study last year, which we are still analyzing, where we're trying to understand how the dogs become jealous of other dogs. But rather than use an actual live dog as the other one, we actually have a very realistic statue of a dog that gets fed. And so we observe the reactions of the dog in the scanner to seeing another dog fed.
That is so funny. I'm wondering about different types of dogs, different breeds of dogs, and different intelligences of those dogs. As I mentioned before, Border Collies, you know, seem to be one of the smarter dogs. However, I do have this Border Collie mix at home, Oscar, and I never attribute any emotions to him other than the sheer excitement of him thinking that every step you take is a step towards the door and he's going with you. I mean, are there just some dogs that don't even register, you know, thoughts and emotions on the MRI scan?
Well, I don't think so, not in that way. But I think one of the big surprises, or at least the thing that surprises me most about our work, is how individual each of the dogs actually is. And, I mean, I guess this is not totally surprising if you've lived with enough dogs. You know that they're all individuals and have different personalities. But it's interesting to see that in our experiments where, you know, on any study that we do, the dogs are kind of like humans in the sense that there's a continuum. We have some dogs who, you know, might respond one way and then other dogs who respond totally opposite. And then, you know, we report the averages, but what's really interesting are kind of the individual differences. And we started to link those to the dog's personalities and how they act outside the scanner on various other behavioral tasks and even some measures of personality. We haven't done anything with breeds because there's so many breeds, and, you know, we have a lot of MRI dogs now, but not enough to really in-depth study by breed.
Yeah, it's a lot of dogs you'd have to train to lie still. I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're kind of concentrating or focusing on these positive traits or emotions that you may be able to pick up. But I know that we've all heard our friends, or maybe even we ourselves, have described our dog as being depressed. And the first time I heard that, a friend of mine was talking about how depressed her dog was. I thought she was crazy. And then later on in life, I got a dog who suffers from depression from time to time. Is that a thing? Is that real?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I think certainly anxiety is real in dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, we can see that in the scanner, and that's kind of one of these traits that seems to vary a great deal from one dog to another. And in fact, one of the larger studies we did last year was we teamed up with Canine Companions for Independence, which is one of the largest trainers of service dogs in this country. And the idea was to train some of their dogs for the MRI before they go through what they call advanced training and see if we could predict which dogs would become good service dogs. And we did this in 50 dogs. And what we found was that, yes, we actually could predict which dogs would ultimately be matched with a person. And the key structure in the brain was a structure called the amygdala, which is one of the structure is known to be critical in anxiety, possibly depression. I don't think these dogs were depressed. But the point is, we were seeing activity in the dog's brain in an area that seemed to be associated with anxiety, even though the dog was not showing outward signs of it. And so this is important because it shows that we have a window into the dog's mind that gets past even the outward manifestations of it. And so the idea is maybe if we start picking these things up earlier, you know, we can, if the dog's depressed or anxious, maybe we could intervene and help the dog with training or medication if necessary, same as with a human, and even tailor training based on this kind of brain responses like a measure of internal state.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with New York Times bestselling author Gregory Burns. He's written the book, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. So can we move on to, and your choice, sea lions, dolphins, other animals that you have studied and what you have learned?
Sure. So probably the animal that I'm most fascinated and obsessed by is now a now extinct animal called the Tasmanian tiger. And I got interested in this animal a couple of years ago when I saw videos of it, old films of this animal that lived in Tasmania almost 100 years ago. And it wasn't a tiger. It actually looked kind of like a coyote. It's probably the closest description. But what's strange about it is it's actually a marsupial, meaning that it's related closer to opossums and kangaroos and Tasmanian devils. And so I have this question was that if they look like coyotes or dogs even, what do their brains look like? Did they evolve brain mechanisms similar to dogs? And so this set off a hunt of mine for the last probably 2 years to literally search the world for any brain specimens that still existed from this animal. The last one died in 1936. And so we did some specialized MRI scans of these specimens. I actually found two. One is at the Smithsonian, and then one is in Australia, and try to reconstruct the brain and the mind of this now long-gone animal. And what we found is that even though the outward appearance is very dog-like, their brain is wired quite differently, and they probably were not, they wouldn't have made good pets, shall we say, even though they looked like dogs. And we actually could learn something about, a little bit about their social structure, perhaps how they hunted, and kind of put together the whole picture and reconstruct what it was like to be that particular animal.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you can go through a taxidermied Tasmanian tiger and still see the structure of the brain, huh?
Well, like I said, there's only two specimens that I found that were preserved in such a way that we could do that. The key thing being that that when the animal died, that the brain was extracted and preserved whole.
Oh, right.
So there were two. There's, you know, the Smithsonian has one sitting in a jar, and so does the Australian Museum.
Oh, I see. Okay. Before we let you go, I just have to mention that here in Park City, we have a dog whisperer, Julie Morgan, and anyone who has ever taken their dog to see her, or she's a dog, you know, a pet psychic. And I just have to ask you about that because the stories I've heard, and I've never taken my dogs, not for any reason other than I just haven't gotten around to it. The stories you hear are absolutely fascinating. And I'm just wondering if you have come across that sort of thing in all of your study and what you think about it.
Well, I'm a skeptic about stuff like that. I think, you know, for someone skilled in observing animal behavior and mannerisms, I think you can probably say a lot that's very plausible about what might be happening inside that animal. You know, it's kind of like the skill of cold reading people. I think, you know, some people are very good at that. Yeah. And are remarkably accurate. I think probably the same thing can be said about a dog or a cat, perhaps. But there's no way to verify it. So how do you know?
That's right. Well, let's see. Maybe you could pair up and somewhere between the pet's psychic reading and the MRI scanner, you might come to a great discovery.
I'm curious about what we can learn from these dogs. I mean, we certainly know about some of their sensitivities. They say that when we walk into a room, we can smell a birthday cake that has just been just come out of the oven. And when a dog walks in that same room, the dog can smell every ingredient that went into that cake. And, so I'm curious what we can learn. And I know that there's some work being done for dogs that are able to sniff out cancer, for an example, or explosives, and being able to digitize that information so that maybe machines can be able to do that for us. What are your thoughts on what we can learn from dogs?
Yeah, so that's I've heard that as well about dogs being able to smell every ingredient. And, that's currently more myth than fact, because I don't think anyone knows the answer to that, because you have to be a dog to tell that. So we've actually begun several studies of olfaction to try to figure this out. And just doing basic things like presenting single molecule odorants to the dogs while they're in the scanner, and then presenting mixtures of that with something else, and then trying to interpret the brain activity to see, is the dog processing that as kind of A plus B plus C, or is it something totally different when you mix it up? Mm-hmm. And so, with this technology, I think we will be able to answer the question. Now, it's largely for this reason. In fact, most of our research is funded actually by the Navy.
Right.
Because of their use of military working dogs and bomb detection dogs, because that is the million-dollar question that they want to know the answer to.
Okay. Gregory Burns, What It's Like to Be a Dog and Other Adventures in Animal Neuroscience. Gregory, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We shall return right after these messages.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, love your home.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. We'd like to thank our underwriters today, Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. That was very interesting.
It was.
John, between time travel and what our dogs are thinking and feeling, I love it. Looking forward to, in a couple of weeks, a Future in Review program back up at Stein Erickson Lodge. We'll speak about animals again. Stay tuned now for NPR News.